Now, what are you running from?
People say, I'm not running from anybody. I don't have any fears that I run from anyone. However, what do people, ordinary people, fear most? One might also ask the question, well, what are people looking for? You might think if a person is running, they're running for something or toward something. That's not always the case. As a matter of fact, that's rarely the case. When a person runs, they're running probably from something, but they are looking for something. They're looking for a place where they can say, I can stop here. This is where I belong. But it's got to be the right place. Some people, unfortunately, never find that place. Some people will find that place, whatever that may be for them. But it's a very interesting idea. Why did Forrest Gump run? What did he say? How many of you saw the picture? You saw the picture? Sure, very popular picture, Forrest Gump. You ought to go see it if you haven't seen it. Or you get it on a DVD movie. He ran. He started running across the country, that is the United States, and he started running back again. I don't know how many times he did it. He ran for almost 3 years, and his hair and beard grew longer, and he looked weird, and pretty soon they started interviewing him on television and about the man who was just running. And so they asked him the question, why are you running, Forrest? And he says, I just felt like running. Well, if you follow the story, he thought he found the girl that he was in love with, the girl of his dreams, but she left him for a lifestyle he knew little about. In the story, I believe the author and the screenwriter captured it brilliantly, what a simple person did. It was easy to see in his life. He just kept moving. He just kept running. He was running. He didn't know why he was running, or at least he didn't say why he was running. Maybe after a while, he figured out why he ran. And there he is at the end of the story, finally having achieved the place where he wanted to be, at least in his mind. And it was totally unimagined before, but as in all good stories, it has a good ending. And he's telling this lady sitting at a bus stop about life, what happened to him, where he was. He had stopped running. And now he was sitting at the bus stop waiting for the bus. And maybe the bus will come soon, but maybe not. But it didn't matter. You see, he had already arrived. It was just an absolutely fantastic story. He had already arrived. And he knew that. And he didn't mind telling people about it. So with a very simple story like Forrest Gump, you could see the point. But for many of us, our lives are more complex than that. But it's still the same. We all run. There are some telltale signs that all is not well. And as soon as I say that, you might say, yeah, I can see that. That's true. A person may not be specifically running, that is, literally running. Comes a point sometimes, maybe we can't run anymore. That is, literally run. But we're running. There may be other things we do that are equivalent. There is a dissatisfaction of where we are all at. We've done things. We've experienced things. And we don't like what's happened. Maybe we quit school. Maybe we leave marriages and we find somebody else. People leave churches and they go to another one. Maybe, and they say, they have something for me. Doesn't really happen. They're running. They say, I'm running looking for something. I say just the opposite. They're running away from something. They always do. People leave homes. People leave parents. And they run. I remember specifically when I ran. I did. Oh, yes. Literally ran. out the house, and in my mind, never to return. And I ran. Was I running towards something? No. I was running away from something. It had to stop one day, and it did. It did stop. Came face to face with something, and that's where it all stopped. It has to happen that way. You have to quit running away. You have to come face to face with some important truths, the most important truths you could ever have. And that stops the running. It really does. There's a time to change jobs. I don't mean to apply this to jobs. Jobs are like that. But it can also be indicative what you think you really want to do. That is, it hasn't been settled. So we keep searching. Maybe it is we're running to find something else. But in reality, it is running away from something. There's something there that we can't stay. We have to move on. Unfortunately, the situation today lends itself to that. People don't stay in jobs very long today. They move from one job to another, maybe about a year and a half, 2 years. That seems to be the way it is. But how much of that is we have to move on? We have to move on because whatever it is that we're looking for wasn't there. Some people have to start their own business. It'd be very good if you did. You might find what you're looking for there. That is in that way. There are a lot of people in upper management and in companies who experience CEOs who are inept. They really are. There are situations like that. They really don't know what they're doing. And so you might say, well, how did they get there? I'll tell you how they get there. They're running. And it looks like these are real movers and shakers because they're running. After all, they're moving. They're able to convince themselves. And they're able to convince others. Why, look at this person. This person must know something. They are always moving. And always mistaking, then, movement of this kind for something meaningful. And it really isn't. But they're moving. But it's convincing a lot of people. And so we tend to think, wow, they must be the best. Well, they aren't. Because they don't give sometimes responsible leadership. They keep everyone upset. They are never satisfied because they're still running. And the problem is with the person himself or herself. You know, when a person finds a job that he really likes. He said, I really like this job. It doesn't say something about the job. It says something about the person. A whole lot more than it says something about the job. The person has gotten some things settled in his life. And that's the main thing. They've got things squared away. They've reconciled a lot of things. And like Forrest Gump, they finally figured out, I don't have to run anymore. They're there. Now you might say, I don't know that this is going on in my life. You're just making this up. This is a lot of psycho battle. Well, listen to me. Think about it. It's not so far out as what you think. If your marriage is tumultuous, you may point the finger at your wife, your children, your job. But really, you ought to look at yourself in the mirror. You might find some answers. If you stay there long enough, you might see some things. That's where you have to be. Did you ever notice it may be painful to stay in front of the mirror? It is sometimes, you know. And you know what? After a while, we begin to reason, there's something wrong with the mirror. Why, look at it. This thing hadn't been cleaned for so long. Besides, it's cracked. Oh, yeah. It's funny how we look at it. It's the mirror's fault. Just like the evil whatever she was in Snow White. You know? People who have quit running have asked the question, and they've come to the answer. But they do ask the question, why am I running? And they begin to see that it's in their heads. The footsteps they hear behind them, from which they are fleeing, they're not there at all. They don't exist. That's the object, of course, of the story I wrote in the pastor's update. Nobody was after the man. I hope you got that. I mean, that was kind of clear. I gave enough clues to show that it was all in his imagination. He was running. He was running from something. And it's there if you simply read it. There are some telltale signs of people who run. People who are angry. It's interesting. Judgmental. Moody. Perhaps they are exclusive in their friendships. All signs of immaturity, we might say. But what are they running from? Perhaps they're defensive. People who tend to shift blame. You ever notice how the conversation begins to shift at times? Good sign of running away. Demanding of others. Why do you want to focus on others? They don't want the spotlight on them. They're running. Now, that is an interesting one there, because sometimes we can tend to be very demanding of others, especially in marriages. We become demanding. There are expectations. We have it in our minds. And so we become demanding, and you have a relationship simply that tends to break down. As I said, I think we ought to look at the mirror, or look into the mirror. Now, the problem is, really, that they're very dissatisfied with themselves. That's what they ought to think about. They're very dissatisfied with themselves. And in the meantime, they make life miserable for other people. And it's something we have to bear. This is a more of a natural phenomenon than what we might think. So the Bible says, you bear with one another's weaknesses. Galatians chapter 6, you bear with one another. What do we have to bear with? Sometimes we have to bear quite a bit. Don't we? We have to put up with quite a bit. We have to wait until the person gets through running away. When they get finished, they become really nice people. People you wouldn't want to be around. But in the meantime, they're still running. Still searching. I read this article once, and I still have it somewhere. The psychotic in the workplace. These are very interesting people. They expect maybe 10% of the people in the workplace are psychotic in some way. And they all tend to be in upper management. Okay, see a few smiles out here. I found it fascinating. In fact, all you got to do, you can Google this, by the way, and you'll find more articles and write-ups and people who make submissions. It's out there, but nobody wants to talk about this very much, about the psychotic in the workplace. They tend to get along with the boss, by the way. Oh, yeah. The people above them, they get along fine. They make life miserable, however, for their coworkers and their peers and those below them. And the article went on to give a number of points as to how to handle these sort of people. Now, that's not what my sermon is about today, how to handle them, though I know some of you are wishing that I would give that. All right. In the meantime, as I said, everyone who has arrived, they are content, they're happy with their lives, have to bear with those who are still running. So in some way, we have to be patient. We have to learn to manage that. See, we were all once running ourselves. Maybe we still are. I hope now, if we run, and the Bible does speak of this, that we run differently than we did before. Let's notice 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24. 1 Corinthians 9, 24. Do you not know that those who run in a race
all run, but one receives the prize. Run in such a way that you may obtain it. For everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Notice that. There's a temperance here. There's a self-control, one might say. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Forrest Gump ran with uncertainty. He didn't know why he was running. He was just running. Paul says, when I run, I have a reason. He said, thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. You're just not there failing away. When you fight, you know exactly what you're fighting. It's deliberate. It's focused. You know what the enemy is. And you do it in such a way where it's very specific, in other words, as to how you fight. And so you have to run. You have to fight. You just don't run from something. When you do, as I said, there are telltale signs that you're running from something. You're not running like this. You're running from something. He says, he goes on, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. So you find here that he was running towards something specific, not running away from something. We'll see a little bit more about Paul in his pre-conversion days in just a moment. Let's look briefly at this story, however. Genesis 27, verse 41. Now, I covered this, I can't remember, was it last week, week before, I just can't recall, about Jacob. I think it was last week. And a little bit different point, but it still makes the point. Genesis chapter 27, 41. So Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing which his father had blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand. And then I will kill my brother Jacob. And the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So he sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, surely your brother Esau comforts himself concerning you by intending to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, rise, flee to my brother Laban in Haran. I want you to get the point here. He is going to flee from something. He's going to run. And begin then a couple of decades, I think, maybe 3 decades. I don't know. I never added up the years. In which then he was running from something. Very interesting. But he had a past. Genesis 28:10. Now Jacob went out from Beersheba, went toward Haran, and so he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place, put it at his head, and he laid down in the place to sleep. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth, and he reached, and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. He didn't say he was the God of Jacob. Notice that. We see that term coming along a little bit later. He says, I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac. He's sort of acknowledging, I'm not your God yet. You're running. And you're going to keep running for a while. And then when you get through, I'll be your God. That's kind of the way it would work. But he does say this. He says, I'll give you the land on which you lie to you and your descendants. Verse 14. And your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, the north and the south. And in you and your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you, and I have done what I have spoken to you. He said, I'm not going to leave you. I'm still going to be with you. I just want you to understand that. Now, there was a lot more that he needed to learn. Jacob woke up from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. That's something he would then, for the next couple of decades, be searching for, that place where the Lord was. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. So he goes to Laban. He stays there, marries Leah, marries Rachel, has children from them, two handmaidens, has a dozen kids, various ages. One of them was born later. I didn't mean to jump the gun on that one. But you get the point. And Jacob, this is Genesis 31:20, and Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. Now, not only is he fleeing, now he's sneaking out. Oh, he's got to run. He's still running. So he fled with all that he had. And he arose and crossed the river and headed toward the mountains of Gilead. And that's the Golan Heights, by the way. That's where he went to, out of Syria. You hear a lot about that today, but that's basically where it was. And headed back down toward the land where God wanted him to go. Now, there's some things he has to face. And so we see this in Genesis chapter 32, verse 6. Genesis 32, verse 6. He's on the way. Esau has long since been set south of Beersheba. That's way south into kind of a semi-desert, semi-arid land. And that's where Esau finally went, where Isaac, his father, had sent him. Because he knew one day Jacob would be coming back. And it was to go to Jacob, not Esau. Verse 6. Then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we came to your brother Esau, and he also was coming to meet you with 400 men with him. And Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. Now, if he was any kind of afraid before, now he was really afraid. And he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two companies. And he said, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the other company, which is left, will escape. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac. Now he's praying to God. Very interesting. who said to me, return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you. He's still not Jacob's God. Notice, even here, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies of the and of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him. Was he running? Sure, he was running. Does he want to run again? Yeah, he wants to run some more. But now he can't. Now he's got to face it. For I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, I surely will treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for the multitude. So he's remembering the statements that were passed down from Abraham to Isaac. But there's some things now that he has to face. What does he have to face? You might say, well, now he has to face Esau. Oh, he does. But he's got to face more than that. He's got to face some things going on in his head. They've been there for a long time. And he's been on the run. And he never could get rid of them. But they were there. The footsteps were always behind him, no matter how hard he tried to get rid of them. Verse 22, and he rose that night and took his two wives and his two female servants and 11 sons. Yeah, it was 11. It wasn't 12. The one had not been born yet. And crossed over the ford Jabbok. And he took them and he sent them over the brook and sent them over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. That's when it happens. People don't like to be alone. They want to keep moving. They want to stay in somebody's company. They want to keep running. They don't want to face it. Now he's left alone. Now he's got to face some things. They're coming. They're coming back. He's got to deal with it. Where are they? They're inside his head. His past. His manner. His way. His name was Jacob. Remember, the supplanter. The one who grasped. The one who took. The one who strove with men. And prevailed. He won. Quite an extraordinary person. Oh, yes. You want to beat somebody at their own game? He was cunning. He was smart. He could do it. But the fear was still there. Doesn't get rid of the fear, does it? You know, it's very interesting. I can say this looking back as a young man. Young men they wonder what makes a man. Did you ever think about that? Is it your bravado? Is it your strength? Is it how well you can deal with other men and dominate them? Is that what makes a man? A man's man. He deals with men. He knows how to deal with men. He's brave. He's not afraid. He's strong. Muscular. Oh, yes. Impressive. Is that a man? You may have the wrong idea as to what a man is. Because there's a lot more to it than that. Jacob's about to learn something here. a man, to become a man, it's not a matter of facing another man in a fight or in a contest and struggling and winning and dominating. Testosterone is not a man. Okay, not at all. But there is something you have to face. And it's how you face it that makes you a man. How you deal with it. How you look at it. Now, you can run. And a lot of people who are very strong, very sportsmanlike, people who have done well in today's world, and we think that these are accomplished men. But they've been running all their lives, and they still are. You can go to the footballers. You can go to the rugby guys. They're out there. They're so full of demons. I don't speak literally. That's figuratively. They're demons. But they like to think they're men because they're tough. But they beat up women. They get into the alcohol. Tell me about manhood now. Explain this to me. They can do anything they want to do. They're not the real men. Just because they're strong. Just because you got to use twice as much deodorant in your armpits. These are not men. These are still wimps. And if I was in the trenches, on the battlefield, I don't want these people next to me. Just a fact. I got to have somebody who is able to face sometimes the most difficult things. The most difficult things you have to face are right here. Right there. And the person who has faced it, seen it, these are the real men. And they're able then, they don't have to run anymore. They're not running from anything any longer. Well, as I said, there are telltale signs. They might not literally run, but there's plenty of signs. Now, he says here, Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking day. And when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. We do have Jacob here being, once again, quite an accomplished person here. Even his hip is out of joint. He's going to hang on to this guy. And now he understands to some extent who he is. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." Which one was the most important? And Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why is it that you ask about my name?" He said, "Who are you?" You see, every man has to come to that. Every man has to face that. He said, "My name, as always, is my name." That's what he always said. That's who I am. He says, "You got to figure out who you are. You're going to prevail with men? I mean, are you going to struggle with men? You're going to fight with men? You're going to try to be somebody in the way men normally do? Is that what you're going to do? Are you going to face your own fears? So who are you?" That's what God said to him. So when ask me who I am, you ask yourself who you are. And you get that squared away. And you don't have to run anymore. And I believe he did. And so he blessed him. Changed his name to Israel, which means a prince with God. You see, he had to face the truth. Not Jacob the supplanter, not the one who strove with men, but the person who wrestled with God. And he wrestled with God until he came to understand the truth. And that's when he received the blessing. Now God was going to be with him. And it turned out that he faced Esau in a very humble way. A way in which he never dealt with Laban. A way in which he never dealt with Esau to start with. Now he's got to do it differently. He's got to do it the way a man does it. And so he comes to Esau, he bows down, and calls him Lord. A human term, not in a godly way. Now Jacob becomes the man. Okay? Now, you have to face it. Acts chapter 9, verse 1. Let's see about somebody else here. "And Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. And he journeyed as he came near Damascus, and suddenly a light shone round him from heaven, and he fell to the ground, and he heard a voice saying, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And he said, 'Who are you, Lord?' And the Lord said, 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. It is hard for you to kick against the goats.'" In other words, a goat is a sharp stick that the driver of the cart would simply stick in the rear end of the oxen. And the oxen would kick against it, always kick against it. There was something always there, always following him, always there, sticking him in the back. He could never figure out what it was. And he meets Jesus Christ, and then it hits him like a ton of bricks. This is what's been bothering me all along. Here's what he's never faced. Now he's got to face it. He's running from something. Doesn't matter where he runs. He's going to persecute the people in Jerusalem of the church. Now he goes to Damascus, he's going to persecute them. Oh, you might say he's running to do something. No, he's running from something. Very clearly, he's running from something. One can imagine what his past might be. How do you get to be that kind of a person? How do you get to the where you can put people to death? How can you get to where you can completely ignore the screams of people, women and children, and you can put them to death? What kind of person are you? What is in your past that you're running from that you'll do something like this? Yes, everybody had to bear with it until God rescued him. Whatever he was running from, it wasn't far behind him. It was always there, and it hurt. Now, he, verse 6, trembles and astonished, said, "Lord, what do you want me to do?" And the Lord said to him, "Rise and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do." And the men who journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice, but seeing no one. And then Saul arose from the ground, and when his eyes were opened, he saw no one, but they led him by the hand. Notice, the man who was running away, and running faster than anybody else, now had to be led by the hand. Now he had to face something. He had to see some things. He was blind. And he began to see some things better than he ever saw them before. He quit running from something. What drove him? As I said, we may never know. But he was not a content man. Philippians chapter 4, verse 1. He writes this remarkable section here, Philippians 4, verse 1. "Therefore, my beloved and longed for brethren, my joy and crown, so stand fast in the Lord, beloved." Okay, it comes a time when you have to get rid of all your insecurities. It's a time when you stand fast. And it says you stand fast in the Lord. All of the things that drive us are gone. You simply stand. You stop. This is where I'm stopping. Here. Everybody who's ever run has to stop somewhere. That's what Paul is saying. Here's where you stop. He didn't say you were perfect. He said, here's where you stop. He goes on, he says, "I implore Euodia and I implore Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. I urge you also, true companion, to help these women who labored with me in the gospel, and with Clement also, the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life." Okay. Now he goes on he puts that as an insert, perhaps has something to do with what he's saying here. "But rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say, rejoice." Now he says, there's a certain way to be here. Let your gentleness be known to all men. Is Paul saying this? Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing. Here is the most strung out guy you ever want to see. Now, be anxious for nothing. But in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And he began to preach Jesus Christ, and he said, this is what I got to do. And it began to say the whole theology of the Jews were so wrong, it was not even close. So he says, prayer, supplication in this manner. Not the rote, memorized prayers in the form twice a day of the Jews. "And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." Now he was a person of peace. beyond anything that he could ever imagine. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's any praiseworthy, meditate on all these things. You know what stops you from meditating on these things? Well, you should guess it by now. You're running. You're still moving. You're still escaping. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again, though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard of need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. Is this Paul? Content? Content. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. And here's a person who was really content. He really was. He wasn't running anymore. He wasn't fighting. He wasn't striving with anybody. He wasn't contending with man. He hadn't developed a religion to show how good he was in order to promote himself in the eyes of men. He left all of that. He says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Now this is maturity. No need to run from anything. No need to run from your past. Let's talk about Peter, James, and John. Matthew 26, 31 through 46. Matthew 26, 31 through 46. Jesus said to them, this is right after the Passover service he had with him. Jesus said to them, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you into Galilee. And Peter answered and said to him, even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. Jesus said to him, assuredly I say to you, this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And Peter said, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And so said all the disciples. Now, this is kind of fascinating here, is what he's doing. He's telling the disciples this. Now, he knew they were all running from something. They hadn't settled this yet. Oh, they were running. Oh, they were with him. They didn't have the total correct and right idea as to how it was all going to happen. Oh, they wanted the kingdom of God, and they wanted a place in it, and they were still talking about it right up until the time of the Passover service. Who's going to be the greatest? They're still running from something. Oh, yes, they are. They all are. They never realized that they had arrived. But they were running. Peter, the impulsive, the one with the answer, the boldest among them. What are you all about, Peter? James and John, the ones who made the play for the top positions. James and John, the sons of thunder, powerful men in their own right, formed by the hard work of being Galilean fishermen. Oh, real men. Indeed they were. Peter is ready to take out a sword and take on a whole band of people. Real man? One might say so. He proclaims his loyalty. He proclaims he will never deny him. But he's still running. So he takes three of them. Notice, Peter, James, and John. To the garden.
And Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, "You sit here while I go and pray over there." And Jesus took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. And he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me." And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." You see, he was a real man. He was willing to face it. He was willing to look at it. He was willing to take the step to come to this earth. He says, "I'll face it." He was willing to go up against the devil after fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. He was willing to face it. He was willing to face the onslaught of all of humanity. Now, there was a man. Perhaps one that you and I need to come face to face with and have a good look at him. You see, whenever I quit running, that's who I saw. And that's why I quit running. It all happened in a space less than a year. I found the place. Never questioned it since. I said, "This is where I'm stopping. Right here." So Jesus faces the inevitable. He faces up to it. Comes to his disciples. He finds them sleeping and says to Peter, "What, could you not watch with me 1 hour?" And of course, he knew what Peter would do. "Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, a second time, he went away and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass from me unless I drink it, your will be done." Now, that's the sign of a person who's not running away. "Your will be done." And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. And so he left them, and he went away again and prayed the third time. And then he came to his disciples, and he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. My betrayer is at hand." I'm going to look him in the eye. I'll look him in the eye, and all of them. You with me or not? And they were until they got there. And that's the place where they all fled. And he was alone. But he was ready to face it at this point. So he's saying to Peter, James, and John, "Are you really with me? What are you running from? Why are you here? What are you running from? Why are you here?" That's what God wants to know. So after it's all over, Peter says, what? Peter says, "I'm out of here. Let's go to Galilee." This is where they all now have to face the real issue. Why am I running? And what am I running from? John 21, verse 15. And so we have this dialogue here taking place. The resurrected Christ, after he died, they knew he had died. They knew he had been resurrected. They go to Galilee. They're out fishing. They bring back some fish off the boat. So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, you knew it was going to come up, didn't you? "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?" Ah, now we see the issue here, don't we? That's it. Not just, "Do you love me?" He asked that later. But right now, he says, "You love me more than these?" What do you think is going on in Peter's mind? James and John made the play.
Peter says, but they don't love him the way I do. He says, okay. So Christ asked him, you love me more than these? He says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And so he said, feed my lambs. The issue was in his mind. It was there all along. He still heard the footsteps. They were following him. Didn't matter where he went. Go to Galilee. Get back on the boat. Something he's familiar with. Goes back to something that he really loved doing. Fishing. Couldn't get rid of the footsteps. They haunted him. They were following him wherever he went. They weren't far behind. What's your fear? Verse 16. And he said to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, tend to my sheep. What do you want to be, Peter? You want to be the chief apostle? You want to be the main man? You want to be the one with the most powerful and assertive personality? You want a position, Peter? What do you want? What are you running from? And what do you think you're going to get at the... What do you think you're going to find? What do you think is going to happen? All he says, feed my sheep. That's it. He doesn't say, I want you to be the main guy to preach the gospel to the whole world and be recognized as such. He doesn't say that. A lot of things he doesn't say to him. He just says this one thing. Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hand, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. Peter, this is the ultimate. This is where you stop. This is where it all stops. And he spoke this, saying, by what death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, follow me. Very profound, isn't it? Nothing like being the first pope, as they say, or being anything. He said, follow me. Peter repeats this back there. He talks about following Christ, and he talks about tending his sheep, doesn't he? He talks about Christ being the chief shepherd, and all of us who are shepherds, and anybody who's a shepherd. He said, this is what you do. 1 Peter chapter 5, it's all in there. Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who also had leaned on his breast at the supper, and said, Lord, who is the one? And he said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? He's speaking about John now. Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, but Lord, what about this man? And Jesus says, you're not really getting the point, Peter. So Jesus says to him, if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? He said, you're the one. Who are you, Peter? You got that figured out yet? Who are you? Where do you stop? Are you stopping here? You going to go all the way with me? Or are you still going to keep going down the same road you've been going down? Then this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die, yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die. But if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? It makes no matter. Everybody runs from something. And Peter had to face it. You see, this is where the running stops. And sometimes you have to have a good face-to-face with Jesus Christ. You know, that's simply the way it is. You just have to have a good look at it. And you have to stop. And you have to be alone. And you have to figure some things out. They don't come easy sometimes. We think they do, but they don't. Nothing about this is easy. Nothing about this is simply going to happen. But as Jacob was alone with God, so was Peter, alone with God. And you got to sort it out. Every person has to do that. And they have to ask the question, what am I running from?